earlier.
She watches through the shutters as he is carried from the building, just as she watches everything in this place. Sometimes from her cabin in the garden, sometimes from the recesses of the building where she can spy on them unnoticed. The body, in its improvised shroud, is visibly heavy, already stiffening perhaps, unwieldy, a dead weight. The lights in the third floor apartment have been on up until now, blazing out into the night. Now they are extinguished, and she sees the windows become dark blanks, masking everything inside. But it will take more than that to expunge the memory of what has occurred within. Now the light in the courtyard snaps on. She watches as they set to work, hidden from the outside world behind the high walls, doing everything that needs to be done. Seeing him, she thought she would feel something, but there was nothing. She smiles slightly at the thought that his blood will now be part of this place, its dark secret. Well, he liked secrets. His stain will be here forever now, his lies buried with him. Something terrible happened here tonight. She won't talk about what she saw, not even over his dead body. No one in this building is entirely innocent, herself included. A new light blinks on, four floors up. At the glass, she glimpses a pale face, dark hair, a hand up against the pane. Perhaps there is one innocent in this, after all.
Jess. I'm hunting through Ben's closet in case there's an outfit an old girlfriend left behind. Something I could borrow. Before Theo hung up on me, I was going to tell him that I don't have anything smart to wear this evening, and no time or money to get something. He's barely given me any warning. Just for a moment, I pause my rifling through Ben's shirts and pull one of them against my face. Try, from the scent, to conjure him here, to believe that I will see him standing in front of me soon. But already the smell of his cologne, his skin, seems to have faded a little. It feels somehow symbolic of our whole relationship, that I'm always chasing a phantom. I drag myself away, choose the one of my two sweaters that doesn't have any holes, and brush my hair. I haven't washed it since I arrived, but at least it's less of a bird's nest now. I chuck on my jacket, thread another pair of cheap hoop earrings through my earlobes. I look in the mirror. Not exactly smart, but it'll have to do. I open the door to the apartment. The stairwell's pitch black. I fumble around for the light switch. There's that whiff of cigarette smoke, but even stronger than usual. It smells almost like someone's smoking one right now. Something makes me glance up to my left. A sound, perhaps, or just a movement of the air. And then I catch sight of something out of place. A tiny glowing red dot hovering overhead in the blackness. It takes a moment before I understand what it is. I'm looking at the end of a cigarette butt, held by someone hidden in the darkness just above me. "Who's there?" I say, or try to say, because it comes out as a strangled bleat. I fumble around for the light switch near the door, and finally make contact with it, the light stuttering on. There's no one in sight. My heart still beating double time as I walk across the courtyard. Just as I reach the gate to the street, I hear the sound of quick shuffling footsteps behind me. I turn. It's the concierge, emerging once more from the shadows. I try to take a step away, and when my heel hits metal, I realize I'm already backed right up against the gate. She only comes up to my chin, and I'm not exactly big. But there's something threatening about her nearness. Yes? I ask. What is it?
I have something to say to you,
she hisses. She glances up at the encircling apartment building. She reminds me of a small animal sniffing the air for a predator. I follow her gaze upwards. Most of the windows are dark blanks, reflecting the gleam of the street lamps across the road. There's only one light on upstairs, in the penthouse apartment. I can't see anyone watching us. I'm sure this is what she's checking for, but then I don't think I'd necessarily be able to spot them if they were. Suddenly, she snatches out a hand towards me. It's such a swift, violent action that for a moment I really think she's going to hit me. I don't have time to step away. It's too fast. But instead, she grabs a hold of my wrist in her claw-like hand. Her grip's surprisingly strong. It stings. What are you doing? I ask her.
Just come,
she tells me. And with such authority, I don't dare disobey her.
Come with me now.
I'm going to be late for meeting Theo now, but you can wait. This feels important. I follow her across the courtyard to her little cabin. She moves quickly, in that slightly stooped way of hers, like someone trying to duck out of a rainstorm. I feel like a child in a storybook being taken to the witch's hut in the woods. She looks up at the apartment building several more times, as though scanning it for any onlookers. But she seems to decide that it's worth the risk. Then she opens the door and ushers me in. It's even smaller inside than it looks on the outside, if that's possible. Everything is crammed into one tiny space. There's a bed attached to the wall by a system of pulleys and currently raised to allow us to stand. A washstand. A minuscule antique cooking stove. Just to my right is a curtain that I suppose must lead through to a bathroom of some sort, simply because there's nowhere else for it to be. It's almost scarily neat. Every surface scrubbed to a high shine. It smells of bleach and detergent, not a thing out of place. Somehow, I would have expected nothing less from this woman. And yet the cleanness, the neatness, the little vase of flowers, somehow make it all the more depressing. A little mess might be a distraction from how cramped it is, or from the damp stains on the ceiling, which I'm fairly sure no amount of cleaning could remove. I've lived in some dives in my time, but this takes the biscuit. And what must it feel like to live in this tiny hovel while surrounded by the luxury and space of the rest of the apartment building? What would it be like to live with the reminder of how little you have on your doorstep every day? No wonder she hated me, swanning in here to take up residence on the third floor. If only she knew how out of place I am here too. How much more like her than them I really am. I know I can't let her see my pity. That would be the worst insult possible. I get the impression she's probably a very proud person. Behind her head, and the tiny dining table and chair, I see several faded photographs pinned to the wall. A little girl sitting on a woman's lap. The sky behind them is bright blue, olive trees in the background. The woman has a glass in front of her of what looks like tea, a silver handle. The next is of a young woman, slim, dark-haired, dark-eyed, maybe 18 or 19. Not a new photograph. You can tell from the saturated colours, the fuzziness of it. But at the same time, it's definitely too recent to be of the old woman herself. It must be a loved one. Somehow it's impossible to imagine this elderly woman having a family, or a past away from this place. It's impossible, even, to imagine her ever having been young. As though she has always been here. As though she is a part of the apartment building itself. "She's stunning," I say. "That girl on the wall. Who is she?" There's a long silence. So long that I think maybe she didn't understand me. And then finally, in that rasping voice, she says,
"My daughter."
Wow. I take another look at her in light of this, her daughter's beauty. It's hard to see past the lines, the swollen ankles, the clawed hands. But maybe I can see a shadow of it, after all. She clears her throat.
"Vous devez arrêter,"
she barks, suddenly, cutting into my thoughts. "You have to stop." "What do you mean?" I ask. "Stop what?" I lean forward. Perhaps she can tell me something.
"All your questions," she says. "All of your looking. You are only making trouble for yourself. You cannot help your brother now. You must understand that..."
"What do you mean?" I ask. A chill has gone right through me. "What do you mean? I cannot help my brother now." She just shakes her head.
"There are things here that you cannot understand. But I have seen them with my own eyes. I see everything."
"What?" I ask her. "What have you seen?" She doesn't answer. She simply shakes her head.
"I am trying to help you, girl. I have been trying since the beginning. Don't you understand that? If you know what is good for you, you will stop. You will leave this place and never look back."
Sophie, penthouse. There's a knock on the door. I go to answer it and find Mimi standing there on the other side.
"Maman."
The way she says the word, just like she did as a little girl. "What is it, ma petite?" I ask gently. I suppose to others I may seem cold, but the love I feel for my daughter, I'd challenge you to find anything close to it.
"Maman, I'm frightened."
"Shh." I step forward to embrace her. I draw her close to me, feeling the frail nubs of her shoulder blades beneath my hands. It seems so long since I have held her like this, since she has allowed me to hold her like this, like I did when she was a child. For a time I thought I might never do so again. And to be called Maman, it is still the same miracle it was when I first heard her say the word. I have always felt she is more mine than Jacques, which I suppose makes a kind of sense, because in a way she was Jacques' greatest gift to me, far more valuable than any diamond brooch, any emerald bracelet. Something, someone, I could love unreservedly. One evening, roughly a week after the night I had knocked on Benjamin Daniel's door, Jacques was briefly home for supper. I presented him with the quiche Lorraine I had bought from the boulangerie, piping hot from the oven. Everything was as it should be, everything following its usual pattern, except for the fact that a few nights before, I had slept with the man from the third floor apartment. I was still reeling from it. I could not believe it had happened. A moment, or rather an evening, of madness. I placed a slice of quiche on Jack's plate, poured him a glass of wine.
"I met our lodger on the stairs this evening,"
he said as he ate, as I picked my way through my salad.
"He thanked us for supper. Very gracious. Gracious enough not to mention the disaster with the weather. He sends you his compliments.
I took a sip of my wine before I answered. Oh?
He laughed, shook his head in amusement. Your face. Anyone would think this stuff was corked. You really don't like him, do you?
I couldn't speak. I was saved by the ringing of Jacques' phone. He went into his study and took a call. When he returned, his face was clouded with anger.
I have to go. Antoine made a stupid mistake. One of the clients isn't happy.
I gestured to the quiche. I'll keep this warm for you, for when you come back.
No, I'll eat out.
He shrugged on his jacket.
Oh, and I forgot to say, your daughter. I saw her on the street the other night. She was dressed like a whore.
My daughter? I asked. Now that she had done something to displease him, she was my daughter.
All that money, he said.
Sending her to that Catholic school, to try and make her into a properly behaved young woman. And yet she disgraced herself there. And now she goes out dressed like a little slut.
But then perhaps it's no surprise.
What do you mean? But I didn't need to ask. I knew exactly what he meant. And then he left, and I was all alone in the apartment as usual. For the second time in a week, I was filled with rage. White, hot, powerful. I drank the rest of the bottle of wine. Then I stood up and walked down two flights of stairs. I knocked on his door. He opened it, pulled me inside. This time there was no preamble, no pretense of polite conversation. I don't think we spoke one word. We weren't respectful or gentle or cautious with one another now. My silk shirt was torn from me. I gasped against his mouth like someone drowning, bit at him, tore the skin of his back with my nails, relinquished all control. I was possessed. Afterwards, as we lay tangled in his sheets, I finally managed to speak. This cannot happen again. You understand that, don't you? He just smiled. Over the next few weeks, we became reckless, testing the boundaries, scaring ourselves a little. The adrenaline rush, the fear, so similar a feeling to the quickening of arousal. Each seemed to heighten the other, like the rush of some drug. I had behaved so well for so long. The secret spaces of this building became our private playground. I took him in my mouth in the old servant's staircase, my hands sliding into his trousers, expert, greedy. He had me in the laundry room in the cave, up against the washing machine as it thrummed out its cycle. And every time I tried to end it. And every time, I know we both heard the lie behind the words.
Maman,
Mimi says now, and I am jolted abruptly, guiltily, out of these memories.
Maman, I don't know what to do.
My wonderful miracle. My merveille. My Mimi. She came to me when I'd given up all hope of having a child. You see, she wasn't always mine. She was quite simply perfect. A baby, only a few weeks old. I did not know exactly where she had come from. I had my ideas, but I kept them to myself. I had learned it was important, sometimes, to look the other way. If you know that you aren't going to like the reply, don't ask the question. There was just one thing I needed to know, and to that I got my answer. The mother was dead.
And illegal. So there's no paper trail to worry about. I know someone at the mairie who will square the birth certificate.
A mere formality for the grand and powerful house of Meunier. It helps to have friends in high places. And then she was mine, and that was the important thing. I could give her a better life.
Shh,
I say. I'm here. Everything will be okay. I'm sorry I was stern last night with the wine, but you understand, don't you? I didn't want a scene. Leave it all with me, ma chérie. It was, is, so fierce, that feeling. Even though she didn't come out of my body, I knew as soon as I saw her that I would do anything to protect her, to keep her safe. Other mothers might say that sort of thing casually. But perhaps it is clear by now that I don't do or say anything casually. When I say something like that, I mean it.
Jess. I come up out of the Palais Royal metro station. I almost don't recognize the tall, smartly dressed guy waiting at the top of the steps, until he starts walking towards me. You're 15 minutes late, Theo says.
He didn't give me any time, I say, and I got caught up.
Come on, Theo says. We can still make it if we're snappy about it.
I look him over, trying to work out why he looks so different to the last time I met him. Only a 5 o'clock shadow now, revealing a sharp jawline. Dark hair still in need of a cut, but it's had a brush, and he swept it back from his face. A dark blazer over a white shirt and jeans. I even catch a waft of cologne. He's definitely scrubbed up since the cafe. He still looks like a pirate, but now like one who's had a wash and a shave and borrowed some civilian clothes.
That's not going to cut it, he says, nodding at me. Clearly he's not having the same charitable thoughts about my outfit.
It's all I had to wear. I did try to say it's fine.
I thought that might be the case. I brought you some stuff.
He thrusts a Monoprix bag for life towards me. I look inside. I can see a tangle of clothes, a black dress and a pair of heels.
You bought this? Ex-girlfriend. You're roughly the same size, I'd guess.
Ooh, okay. I remind myself that this might all somehow help me find out what's happened to Ben. That beggars can't be choosers about wearing the haunted clothes of girlfriends past.
Why do I have to wear this sort of stuff?
He shrugs.
Them's the rules.
And then, when he sees my expression.
No, they actually are. This place has a dress code. Women aren't allowed to wear trousers, heels are mandatory.
That's nice and sexist. Echoes of the pervert insisting I keep the top 4 buttons of my shirt undone for the punters.
You want to look like you work in a kindergarten, sweetheart, or a branch of fucking McDonald's?
Theo shrugs.
Yeah, well, I agree. But that's a certain part of Paris for you. Hyper-conservative, hyper-critical, sexist. Anyway, don't blame me. It's not like I'm taking you to this place on a date.
He coughs.
Come on. We don't have all night. We're already running late.
For what?
You'll see when we get there. Let's just say, you're not going to find this place in your lonely planet guide.
How does this help us find Ben?
I'll explain it when we get there. It will make more sense then.
God, he's infuriating. I'm also not completely sure I trust him, though I can't put my finger on why.
Maybe it's just that I still can't work out what his angle is, why he's so keen to help.
I hurry along next to him, trying to keep up. I didn't see him standing up at the cafe the other day. I'd guessed he was tall. But now I realise he's well over a foot taller than me, and I have to take 2 steps for every one of his. After a few minutes of walking, I'm actually panting. To the left of us, I catch sight of a huge glass pyramid, glowing with light, looking like something that's just landed from outer space.
What is that thing?
He gives me a look. It seems I've said something stupid.
That's the pyramid. In front of the Louvre? You know, the famous museum?
I don't like being made to feel like an idiot.
Oh, the Mona Lisa, right?
Yeah, well, I've been a bit too busy trying to find my missing brother to take a nice tour of it yet. We push through crowds of tourists chattering in every language under the sun. As we walk, I tell him about what I've discovered, about them all being a family. One united front, acting together, and probably against me. I keep thinking about stumbling into Sophie Minier's apartment, all of them sitting together like that, an eerie family portrait.
the words I'd heard crouching outside. Elle est dangereuse. And Nick, discovering that he wasn't the ally I thought he was. That part still stings. And just before I left to come here, the concierge gave me a kind of warning. She told me to stop looking.
Can I tell you something I've learned in my long and not especially illustrious career?
Theo asks. What?
When someone tells you to stop looking, it normally means you're on the right track.
I change quickly in the underground toilet of a shishi bar while Theo buys a demi beer upstairs so the staff don't chuck us out. I shake out my hair, study my reflection in the fox glass of the mirror. I don't look like myself. I look like I'm playing a part. The dress is figure-hugging, but classier than I'd expected. The label inside reads Isabelle Moron, which I'm guessing might be a step up from my usual Primark. The shoes, Michel Vivian, is the name printed on the footbed, are higher than anything I'd wear, but surprisingly comfortable. I think I might actually be able to walk in them. So I guess I'm playing the part of Theo's ex-girlfriend. Not sure how I feel about that. A girl comes out of the stall next to me. Long, shining, dark hair. A silky dress falling off one shoulder underneath an oversized cardigan. Wings of black eyeliner. She starts outlining her lips in lipstick. That's what I need. The finishing touch. Hey. I lean over to her. Smile my most ingratiating smile. Could I borrow some of that? She frowns at me. Looks slightly disgusted, but hands it over. Si tu veux. I put some on a finger, dab it onto my lips. It's a dark, vampiric red, and pass it back to her. She puts up her hand. Non, merci. Keep it. I have another. She tosses her gleaming hair over one shoulder. Oh, thanks. I put the lid back on, and it closes with a satisfying magnetized click. I notice it has little interlocking C's stenciled on the top. Mum had a lipstick like this, even though she definitely didn't have spare cash to spend on expensive makeup. But then that was Mum all over. Blow it on a lipstick and be left with nothing for dinner. Me, sitting on a chair, legs dangling. Her pressing the waxy stub of it against my lips, turning me to face the mirror. There you go, darling. Don't you look pretty? I look at myself in the mirror now, pout just like she asked me to do all those years, a million years, a whole lifetime ago. There. Done. Costume complete. I head back upstairs. Ready? I tell Theo. He downs the dregs of his stupidly tiny glass of beer. I can feel him running a quick eye over the outfit. His mouth opens, and for a moment I think he might say something nice. I mean, part of me wouldn't know what to do with a compliment right now. But at the same time, it might be nice to hear. And then he points to my mouth.
Missed a bit, he says. But yeah, otherwise that should do.
Oh, fuck off. I rub at the edge of my lips. I hate myself for even having cared what he thought. We leave the bar, turn onto a street thronged with very well-dressed shoppers. I could swear the air around here smells of expensive leather. We pass the glittering windows of rich people shops. Chanel, Celine, and... aha! Isabelle Moron. He leads me away from the crowds into a much smaller side street. Gleaming cars flank the pavements. In contrast to the crowded shopping boulevard, there's no one in sight, and it's darker here, fewer street lamps. A deep hush over everything. Then Theo stops at the door. Here we are. He looks at his watch. Well, we're definitely a little late. Hopefully they'll let us in. I look at the door. No number, but there's a plaque with a symbol I recognise. An exploding firework. Where are we? Theo reaches past me, a trace of that citrus cologne again, and presses a doorbell I hadn't noticed. The door swings open with a click. A man appears, dressed in a black suit and bow tie. I watch as Theo fishes a card from his pocket, the same one I found in Ben's wallet. The doorman glances at the card, nods his head towards us.
Entrez, s'il vous plaît. The evening is about to start.
I try and peer past the doorman to get a glimpse of what lies beyond. At the end of the corridor, I see a staircase leading downwards, dimly lit by sconces with real candles burning in them. Theo plants a hand in the small of my back and, with a little push, steers me forward.
Come on, he says. We don't have all night. Arrêtez,
the doorman says, barring our entry with a hand. He looks me over.
Votre mobile, s'il vous plaît. No phone allowed. Or camera.
Why? I glance back at Theo. It occurs to me again that I know absolutely nothing about this guy beyond what it says on his business card. He could be anyone. He could have brought me anywhere. Theo gives a tiny nod, gestures. Don't make a fuss. Do what the guy says. Okay. I hand my phone over, reluctantly.
Vos masques.
The man holds up two pieces of material. I take one. A black mask, made of silk. What? Just put it on, Theo murmurs, near my ear. And then louder.
Let me help, darling.
I try to act natural as he smooths down my hair, ties the mask behind my head. The doorman beckons us through. With Theo close behind me, I begin to descend the stairs. Jess. An underground room. I see dark red walls, low lighting, a small crowd of dimly lit figures sitting in front of a stage veiled by a wine-coloured velvet curtain. Masked faces turn to look as we descend the final few steps. We're definitely the last to turn up at the party.
What the hell is this place?
I whisper to Theo.
Shh.
An usher in black tie meets us at the bottom of the stairs, beckons us forward. We pass walls decorated with stylized gold dancing figurines, then weave among little booths with masked figures sitting behind tables, more faces turning in our direction. I feel uncomfortably exposed. Luckily, the table we're taken to is tucked into a corner, definitely the worst view of the stage. We slide into the booth. There really isn't very much room in here, not with Theo's long legs, which he has to pull up against himself, his knees hard against the wooden surround. He looks so uncomfortable that in different circumstances, it might give me a laugh. The tiny amount of seat left means I have to sit with my thigh pressed right up against his. I look about. It's hard to tell whether this place is actually old or just a clever imitation. The others around us are all very well heeled. Judging by their clothes, they could be out for an evening at the theatre. But the atmosphere is wrong. I lean back in my chair, trying to look casual, like I fit in here among the tailored suits, the jewel-encrusted earlobes and necks, the rich person hair. A weird, hungry hum of energy is coming off them, coiling through the room. An intense note of excitement, of anticipation. The waiter comes over to take our drinks order. I open the leather-bound menu. No prices. A glance at Theo. A glass of champagne for my wife, he says quickly. He turns to me wearing a smile of fake adoration, so convincing it gives me a chill. Seeing as we're celebrating, darling. I really hope he's paying. He looks down the menu. And a glass of this red for me. The waiter is back in a minute, brandishing two bottles in white napkins. He pours a stream of champagne into a glass and passes it to me. I take a sip. It's very cold, tiny bubbles electric on the tip of my tongue. I can't think when I've ever had the real stuff. Mum used to say she was a champagne girl, but I'm not sure she ever had it either. Just cheap, sweet knockoffs. As the waiter pours Theo's red, the napkin slips a little, and I notice the label. It's the same wine, I whisper to Theo, once the waiter's left us. The Meunier have that in their cellar. Theo turns to look at me. What was that name you just used? He sounds suddenly excited. The Meunier, the family I was telling you about. Theo lowers his voice. Yesterday, I submitted a request to see the Matrice Cadastrale. That's like the land registry for this place. It's owned by one Meunier Wines, S-A-R-L. I sit up very straight, everything sharpening into focus. A feeling like a thousand tiny pinpricks across the surface of my skin. That's them. That's the family Ben's been living with. I try to think. But why was Ben interested in this place? Could he have been reviewing it? Something like that? He wasn't reviewing it for me. And I'm not sure, being so exclusive, that it's the sort of place that exactly courts press coverage. The lights begin to dim. But just before they do, a figure in the crowd catches my eye, oddly familiar despite the mask they're wearing. I try to shift my gaze back to the same spot, but the lights are dimming further, voices lowering, and the room falling into darkness. I can hear the smallest rustle of people's clothing, the odd sniff, their intakes of breath. Someone coughs, and it sounds deafening. In the sudden hush. Then the velvet curtain begins to roll back. A figure stands on the stage against a black background, skin lit up pale blue, face in shadow, completely naked. No, not naked, a trick of the light. Two scraps of material covering her modesty. She begins to dance. The music is deep, throbbing. Some sort of jazz, I think. No melody to it, but a kind of rhythm. And she's so in sync with it that it feels almost as if the music is coming from her. Like the movements she is making are creating it, rather than following it. The dance is strange, intense, almost menacing. I'm torn between staring and tearing my eyes away. Something about it disturbs me. More girls appear, dressed or undressed, in the same way. The music gets louder and louder, beating until it's so overpowering that the pulse of it is like the sound of my own heartbeat in my ears. With the blue light, the shifting, undulating bodies on stage, I feel as though I'm underwater, as though the outlines of everything are rippling and bleeding into one another. I think of last night. Could there be something in the champagne? Or is it just the effect of the lighting, the music, the darkness? I glance over at Theo. He shifts in his seat next to me, takes a sip of wine, his eyes locked on the stage. Is he turned on by what's happening on stage? Am I? I'm suddenly aware of how close we are to each other, of how tightly my leg is pressed up against his. The next act is just two women, one dressed in a close-fitting black suit and bow tie, the other in a tiny slip dress. Gradually they remove each other's clothes, until you can see that without them, they're almost identical. I can feel the audience sitting forward, drinking it in. I lean towards Theo, whisper, "What is this place?" "A rather exclusive club," he murmurs back. "Its nickname, apparently, is Le Petit Mort. You can't get in unless you have one of those cards, like the one you found in Ben's wallet." The lights dim again. Silence falls on the crowd. Another nearly naked girl. This one, wearing a kind of feathered headdress rather than a mask, is lowered from the ceiling on a suspended silver hoop. Her act is all confined to the hoop. She does a somersault, a kind of backflip, lets herself fall and then catches herself with a flick of an ankle. The audience gasps. Theo leans in close. "Careful now, but look behind you," he whispers, breath tickling my ear. I start to swivel around. No, Jesus, more subtly than that. God, he's patronizing. But I do as he says. Several times I take small, sly glances behind me. And as I do, I notice a series of booths hidden in the shadows at the back, their occupants shielded from the view of the regular punters by velvet curtains and attended by a constant flow of waiters carrying bottles of wine and trays of canapes. Every so often, someone leaves or enters, and I notice that it always seems to be a man, all of a similar type and age, elegant, suited, masked, an air of wealth and importance about them. Theo leans over, as though he's whispering another sweet nothing. "Have you noticed? Are they all men?" "Yes. And how every so often, one of them goes through that door over there." I follow the direction of his gaze. "But I'd stop looking now," he murmurs, "before we start to draw attention to ourselves." I turn back to the stage. The girl has stepped off the hoop. She smiles out at the audience, taking us all in a sweeping glance. When she gets to me, she stops. I'm not imagining it. She freezes. She is staring at me in what looks like horror. I feel a thrill go through me. The sharp brown fringe, the height, even the little mole beneath her left eye, which I can make out now under the spotlight. I know her.
Sophie, penthouse. They file into the apartment. Nicholas, Antoine, Mimi take up the same positions on the sofas they occupied last night when the girl interrupted us. Nick's foot is tapping a frantic rhythm on the home rug. As I watch, I am certain I can make out a tiny black scorch mark just beneath his toe, one of several burned into the priceless silk. But you'd only spot them if you knew what you were looking for. Suddenly, I am assaulted by memories. It was my greatest transgression, inviting him up here. We stole a bottle from Jacques' cellar, one of the finest vintages. Had each other there, on the rug, Paris glittering noisily in at us through the vast windows. We lay tangled together afterwards, warmed by the cashmere throw I had poured around our naked bodies. If Jacques had come back unexpectedly, But wasn't there some part of me that wanted to be caught? Look at me, who you have left here alone all these years. Wanted, desired. As we lay there, I stroked his hair, enjoying the dense velvety softness of it between my fingers. He lit a cigarette that we passed back and forth like teenage lovers, hot ash scattering, sizzling into the silk of the rug. I didn't care. All that mattered was that, with him here, the apartment suddenly seemed warm, full of life and sound and passion. My mum used to stroke my hair. I pulled my hand away sharply. I didn't mean it like that, he said quickly. I just meant I hadn't realized how much I missed it. And when he turned to look across at me, I saw in his expression something undefended and frail, something that had hidden beneath all the charm. I thought I saw my own loneliness reflected there. But in the next moment he smiled, and it had vanished. A minute or so later he sat up, shaking in the empty apartment around us. Jacques is away a lot in the evenings, isn't he? I nodded. Was he already planning our next encounter? He's very busy. His gaze seemed to sweep over the paintings on the walls, the furnishings, the richness of the place. I suppose that must mean business is flourishing. I froze. He'd said it lightly. Too lightly? It brought me back to myself. The madness of what we were doing. All that was at stake. You should go, I told him, suddenly angry at him. At myself. I can't do this. This time I really believed I meant it. I have too much to lose. I close my eyes, open them again, and focus on my daughter's face. She does not meet my eye. All the same, it has brought me back to myself, to what is important. I take a steadying sip of my wine, force down the memories. So, I say to them all, let us begin.
Nick, second floor. My stepmother has called us all to order. We're sitting upstairs in the penthouse apartment, a dysfunctional little family conference. Like the one we'd been going to have last night, before Jess turned up unannounced and set the cat among the pigeons. I was always a keen student of English idioms. We have a French one like it, actually. Jeter un pavé dans la mer, throw a paving stone in the pond. And maybe that's a more accurate description of what happened when she arrived here. She has displaced everything. I look at the others. Antoine knocking back the wine. He might as well have picked up the whole bottle. Mimi white-faced and looking ready to bolt from the room. Sophie sitting rigid and expressionless. She's not looking quite herself, my stepmother. I can't work out what's different about her at first. Her shining black bob doesn't have a strand out of place. Her silk scarf is knotted expertly at her throat. But there's something off. Then it hits me. She's not wearing lipstick. I don't know if I've ever seen her without it. She looks diminished somehow, older, frailer, more human. Antoine speaks first. That stupid little cunt is at the club. He turns to me. Still suggest we do nothing, little bro. I think the important thing is we all pull together, I say. A united front as a family. That's the most important thing. We can't fall apart now. But I realize, looking at their faces, that they're all unknown quantities to me. I don't feel like I know these people, not really. I was away for so long, and we're all so estranged from one another, that we don't look and feel like the real thing. Even to one another. Yes, because you've been such a key player in this family up until now, Antoine says, making me feel even more of an imposter, a fraud. He gestures towards Sophie. And you're not going to catch me playing the adoring stepson to that salope. Hey, I say, let's just... Watch your mouth, Sophie says caustically, turning to Antoine. You're sitting in my apartment. Ooh, it's your apartment, is it? He gives a mock bow. I'm so sorry, I hadn't realized. I thought you were just a parasite living off Papa's money. I didn't know you'd earned any of it yourself. I was only 8 or 9 when Papa married the mysterious new woman who had materialized in our lives, but Antoine was older, a teenager. Maman had been an invalid for so long, languishing in her rooms on the 3rd floor. This newcomer seemed so young, so glamorous. I was a little besotted. Antoine took it rather differently. He's always had it in for her.
Just stop it,
Mimi says suddenly, her hands over her ears.
All of you, I can't take any more.
Antoine turns to Mimi with a horrible smile on his face.
Nah.
He slurs at her now. And as for you, well, you're not really part of this family, are you, ma petite sœur? Stop that, Sophie says to Antoine, her voice ice cold, the lioness protecting her cub. At her feet, the whippet startles and gives a sharp bark.
Oh, I think she can give as good as she gets,
Antoine says.
What about all that stuff at her school with the teacher? Papa had to make a pretty hefty donation and agree to remove her to keep that one quiet. But perhaps it's no surprise, huh?
He turns to Mimi. When you consider where she comes from. Don't you dare speak to her like that, Sophie says. Her tone is dangerous. I glance over at Mimi. She's just sitting there staring at Antoine, her face even paler than usual. Okay, I say. Come on, let's all just...
And can I just say, Antoine says, that it's just typical that our darling père has decided to fuck off for all of this, isn't it?
All of us glance instinctively at the portrait of my father on the wall. I know it must be my imagination or a trick of the light, but it looks as though his painted frown has deepened slightly. I shiver. Even when he's miles away, you can still feel his presence in this apartment somehow. His authority. The all-seeing, all-powerful Jacques Meunier. Your father, Sophie says to Antoine now sharply, has his own business to be taken care of. As you well know, it would only complicate things further if he returns. We must all hold the fort for him in his absence.
What a surprise he's not here when the shit hits the fan!
Antoine gives a laugh, but there's no humor in it. He trusts you to be able to handle the situation on your own, Sophie says. But perhaps that is simply too much to ask. Look at you. You're a 40-year-old man still living under his roof, leeching off his money. He has given you everything. You've never had to grow up. You've had everything handed to you by your father on a silver platter. You're both useless hothouse flowers, too weak for the outside world, unable to fly the nest. That stings. For God's sake, she says, show your father some respect.
Oh, yeah?
Antoine gives her a nasty smile.
Are you really going to talk to me about respect?
Putain. The last word hissed under his breath. How dare you speak to me like that? She rounds on him, a surge of real anger breaching the icy facade.
Oh, how dare I?
Antoine gives her a sly-looking grin.
Vraiment?
Really? He turns to me.
You know what she is? You know what our very elegant stepmother really is? You know where she comes from?
I've had my suspicions. As I grew older, they grew too. But I've barely even allowed myself to think them, let alone voice them aloud, for fear of my father's wrath. Antoine stands up and walks out of the room. A few moments later, he comes back carrying something in a large frame. He turns it around so that all of us can see it. It's a black and white photograph, a large nude, the one from my father's study.
Put that back,
says Sophie, her voice dangerous. Her hands are clenched into fists. She looks over at Mimi, who is sitting stock still, her eyes wide and scared. Antoine sits back in the chair, looking pleased with himself, propping the photograph beside him like a child's science project. Look at her, he says, gesturing to the image, then at Sophie. Hasn't she done well? The Hermès scarves, the trench coats, une vraie bourgeoise. You'd never know it, would you? You'd never know that she was really a... A crack, loud as a pistol shot. It happens too quickly to understand what's going on. She moved so fast. Then Antoine is sitting there holding his hand to his face, and Sophie is standing over him. She hit me, Antoine says. But his voice is small and scared as a little boy's. It isn't the first time he's been hit like this. Papa was pretty free with his fists, and Antoine, the eldest, seemed to get the worst of it. She fucking hit me. He takes his hand away, and we all see the mark of her hand on his cheek, the imprint of it a livid pink. Sophie continues to stand over him. Think what your father would say if he heard you talking to me like that. Antoine looks up at Papa's portrait again, tears his eyes away with an effort. He's a big guy, but he seems almost to shrink into himself. We all know that he would never dare speak to Sophie like this in Papa's presence. And we all know that when Papa gets back, there'll be hell to pay if he hears about it. Could we please just focus on what's important? I say, trying to gain some control. We have a bigger problem to focus on here. Sophie gives Antoine another venomous stare, then turns to me and nods tightly. You're right. She sits back down, and in a moment that chilly mask is back in place. I think the most important thing is that we can't let her find out any more. We have to be ready for her when she returns. And if she goes too far, Nicolas, I nod. Swallow. Yes, I know what to do, if it comes to it.
The concierge,
Mimi says suddenly, her voice small and hoarse. We all turn to look at her.
I saw that woman, Jess, going into the concierge's cabin. She was on her way to the gate, and the concierge ran out and grabbed her. They were in there for at least 10 minutes.
She looks at all of us.
What? What could they have been talking about for all that time?
Jess. I stare at the girl on the stage. It's her. The girl who followed me 2 days ago. The one I chased onto the metro train. She stares back. The moment seems to stretch. She looks as terrified as she did when that train pulled away from the platform. And then, as if she's coming out of a trance, she swings her gaze back to the audience, smiles, climbs back onto the hoop as it starts to rise upwards, and is gone. Theo turns to me. What was that?
You saw it too.
Yeah, I saw it. She was staring right at you. I met her, I say, just after I spoke to you for the first time at the cafe. I explain it all, catching her following me, chasing her into the metro. My heart is beating faster now. I think of Ben, the family, the mystery dancer. They all feel like parts of the same puzzle. I know they are. But how do they all fit? After the show ends, the audience members drain the remainders from their glasses and surge up the staircase, heading out into the night. Theo gives me a nudge. Come on then, let's go. Follow me. I'm about to protest. Surely we're not just going to leave. But I stop when I see that rather than continuing up the stairs with the rest of the paying customers, Theo has shoved open a door on our left. It's the same one we noticed earlier, during the performance. The one through which those suited men kept disappearing.
Let's try and talk to your friend, he murmurs. He slips through the door. I follow close behind. Beneath us is a dark, velvet-lined staircase. We begin to descend. I can hear sounds coming from below, but they're muted, like they're coming from underwater. I hear music, I think, and the hum of voices, and then a sudden, high-pitched cry that might be male or female. We have almost reached the bottom of the stairs. I hesitate. I thought I heard something. Another set of footsteps beside our own. Stop, I say. Did you hear that? Theo looks at me questioningly. I'm sure I heard footsteps. We listen for a couple of moments in silence. Nothing. Then a girl appears at the bottom of the stairs. One of the dancers. Up close, she's so made up it looks like she's wearing a mask. She stares at us. For a moment, I have the impression that there's a scared little girl looking out at me, behind the thick foundation, fake eyelashes and glossy red lips. We're looking for a friend, I say quickly. The girl who did that act on the swing. It's about my brother, Ben. Can you tell her we're looking for her?
You cannot be here, she hisses.
She looks terrified. It's okay, I say, trying to sound reassuring. We're not going to stay for long. She hurries past us, up the stairs, without a backward glance. We keep going. At the end of the corridor, there's a door. I put my shoulder against it, but there's no give. I suddenly have a sense of how far underground we are, at least two floors deep. The thought makes it harder to breathe. I try to swallow down my fear. I think it's locked, I say. The sounds are louder now. Through the door, I hear a kind of groan that sounds almost animal. I try the handle again. It's definitely locked. You have a go, but Theo doesn't answer me. And I know, before I turn, that there's someone behind us. Now I see him. The doorman who met us at the entrance, his huge frame filling the corridor, his face in shadow. Shit.
Qu'est-ce qui se passe? He asks,
dangerously, quietly, as he begins moving towards us.
What are you doing down here?
We got lost, I say, my voice cracking. I was looking for the toilets.
Vous devez partir,
he says, and then he repeats it in English.
You need to leave, both of you, right now.
His voice is still quiet, all the more menacing than if he were shouting. It says, absolutely do not fuck with me. He takes a hold of my upper arm in one of his huge hands. His grip burns. I try to pull away. He grips tighter. I get the impression he's not even putting much effort in.
Hey, that's not necessary, Theo says.
The doorman doesn't answer or let go. Instead, he takes hold of Theo's arm too, in his other hand. And Theo, who up until now I'd thought of as a large guy, looks suddenly like a child, like a puppet, held in his grip. For a moment, the doorman stands stock still, his head cocked to one side. I look at Theo and he frowns, clearly as confused as I am. Then I hear a tinny murmur and realize that the doorman is listening. Someone is feeding him instructions through an earpiece. He straightens up.
Please, madame, monsieur.
Still that scarily polite tone.
even as his hand tightens further around my bicep, burning the skin.
Do not make a scene. You must come with me, now.
And then he is steering us, with more than a little force, along the corridor, back up the first flight of stairs, back into the room with the tables, the stage. Most of the lights have been turned off, and it's completely empty now. No, not completely. Out of the corner of my eye, I think I catch sight of a tall figure standing quite still, watching us from the shadowy recesses in one corner. But I don't manage to get a proper look, because now we're being manhandled up the next flight of steps, up to ground level. Then the front door is opened, and we're thrust out onto the street. The doorman giving me such a hard shove in the back that I trip and fall forward onto my knees. The door slams behind us. Theo, who has managed to keep his balance, puts out a hand and hauls me up. It takes a long time for my heartbeat to return to normal. But as I manage to gain some control over my breathing, I realize that though my knees hurt and my arm feels badly bruised, it could have been so much worse. I feel lucky to be back out here gulping freezing lungfuls of air. What if the voice in the doorman's ear had given different instructions? What might be happening to us now? It's this thought rather than the cold that makes me shiver. I pull my jacket tighter around me.
Let's get away from here, Theo says.
I wonder if he's thinking along the same lines. Let's not give them a chance to change their minds. The street is almost silent, completely deserted. Just the blink of the security lights in shop windows and the echo of our feet on the cobblestones. And then I hear a new sound, another pair of feet, behind us and moving quickly, quicker, growing louder as my heart starts beating faster. I turn to see a tall figure, hood pulled up. And as the light catches her face, just so, I see that it's her. The girl who followed me two nights ago. The girl on the hoop, who stared at me in the audience this evening like she'd come face to face with a nightmare.
Concierge, the lodge. I am dusting up on the top floor. Normally, I do the hallways and staircases at this time of day. Madame Meunier is very particular about that. But this evening, I have trespassed onto the landing. It is the second risk I have taken. The first was speaking to the girl earlier. We might have been seen, but I was desperate. I tried to put a note under her door yesterday evening, but she caught me there, threatened me with a knife. I had to find another way, because I saw who she was the first night she arrived, coming to that woman's aid, helping her put the clothes back into her suitcase. I could not stand back and let another life be destroyed. They are all in there, in the penthouse. All apart from him, the head of the family. I could have taken the back staircase. I use it sometimes to keep watch, but the acoustics are much better from here. I can't hear everything they're saying, but every so often I catch hold of a word or a phrase. One of them says his name, Benjamin Daniels. I press a little closer to the door. They are talking about the girl now, too. I think about that hungry, interested, bright way about her. Something in her manner. She reminds me of her brother, yes, but also of my daughter. Not in looks, of course. No one could match my daughter in looks. One day, when the heat had begun to dissipate, I invited Benjamin Daniels into my cabin for tea. I told myself it was because I had to show my gratitude for the fan. But really, I wanted company. I had not realized how lonely I had been until he showed an interest. I had lost the shame I had felt at first about my meager way of living. I had begun to enjoy the companionship. He glanced again at the photographs on the walls as he sat cradling his glass of tea. Elira, have I got that right? Your daughter's name? I stared at him. I could not believe he had remembered. It touched me. That's correct, monsieur. It's a beautiful name, he said. It means the free one. Oh, in what language? I paused. Albanian. This was the first thing I trusted him with. From this detail, he might have been able to guess my status here in France. I watched him carefully. He simply smiled and nodded. I've been to Tirana. It's a wonderful city, so vibrant. I have heard that, but I don't know it well. I'm from a small village on the Adriatic coast. Do you have any pictures? A hesitation. But what harm could it do? I went to my tiny bureau, took out my album. He sat down in the seat across from me. I noticed he took care not to disturb the photographs as he turned the pages, as though handling something very precious. I wish I had something like this, he said suddenly. I don't know what happened to the photos from when I was small, but then again, I don't know if I could look. He stopped. I sensed some hidden reservoir of pain. Then, as though he had forgotten it, or wanted to forget it, he pointed at a photograph. Look at this, the color of that sea. I followed his gaze. Looking at it, I could smell the wild thyme, the salt in the air. He glanced up. I remember you said you followed your daughter to Paris, but she isn't here any longer? I saw his gaze flicker around the cabin. I heard the unspoken question. It wasn't as though I had left poverty at home for a life of riches here. Why would a person abandon their life for this? I did not intend to stay, I said. Not a first. I glanced up at the wall of photographs. Elira looked out at me, at 5, at 12, at 17. The beauty growing, changing, but the smile always the same. The eyes the same. I could remember her at the breast as an infant. Dark eyes looking up at me with such brightness and intelligence beyond her years. When I spoke, it was not to him, but to her image. I came here because I was worried about her. He leant forward. Why? I glanced at him. For a moment, I had almost forgotten he was there. I hesitated. I had never spoken to anyone about this. But he seemed so interested, so concerned. And there was that pain I had sensed in him. Before, even when he had shown me the little kindnesses and attentions, I had seen him as one of them, a different species, rich, entitled. But his pain made him human. She forgot to call when she said she would, and when I eventually heard from her, she didn't sound the same. I looked at the photographs. I tried to find a way to describe it. She told me she was busy, she was working hard. I tried not to mind. I tried to be happy for her. But I knew, with a mother's instinct, I knew something was wrong. She sounded bad. Hoarse, ill. But worse than that, she sounded vague, not like herself. Every time we had spoken before, I felt her close to me, despite the hundreds of miles between us. Now I could feel her slipping away. It frightened me. I took a breath. The next time she called was a few weeks later. All I could hear at first were gasps of air. Then finally I could make out the words. I'm so ashamed, Mama. I'm so ashamed. The place, it's a bad place. Terrible things happen there. They're not good people, and... The next part was so muffled I could not make it out. And then I realized she was crying. Crying so hard she could not speak. I gripped the phone tight enough that my hand hurt. I can't hear you, my darling.
I said, I'm not a good person either.
You are a good person, I told her fiercely. I know you, and you're mine, and you're good.
I'm not, Mama. I've done terrible things, and I can't even work there any longer.
Why not? A long pause. So long that I began to wonder if we had been cut off.
I'm pregnant, Mama.
I thought I hadn't heard her properly at first.
You're pregnant?
Not only was she unmarried, she hadn't mentioned any partner to me, anyone special. I was so shocked I couldn't speak for a moment. How many months?
5 months, Mama. I can't hide it any longer. I can't work.
After this, all I could hear was the sound of her crying. I knew I had to say something positive.
But I'm
so happy, my darling, I told her. I'm going to be a grandmother. What a wonderful thing. I'll start getting some money together. I tried not to let her hear my panic about how I would do this quickly enough. I would have to take on extra work. I would have to ask favors, borrow. It would take time, but I would find a way. I'll come to Paris, I told her. I'll help you look after the baby. I looked at Benjamin Daniels. It took some time, monsieur. It was not cheap. It took me 6 months. But finally, I had the money to come here. I had my visa, too, which would allow me to stay for a few weeks. I knew that she would already have had the baby, though I hadn't heard from her for several weeks. I had tried not to panic about this. I had tried instead to imagine what it would be like to hold my grandchild for the first time. But I would be there to help her with the care, and to care for her. That was the important thing. Of course, he nodded in understanding. I had no home address for her when I arrived, so I went to her place of work. I knew the name. She had told me that much. It seemed such an elegant, refined place, in the rich part of town, as she had said. The doorman looked at me in my poor clothes. The entrance for the cleaners is round the back, he said. I was not offended. It was only to be expected. I found the entrance, slipped inside. And because I looked the way I did, I was invisible. No one paid me any attention. No one said I should not be there. I found the women, the girls, who had worked with my daughter, who knew her. And that was when, for a moment, I could not speak. When? He prompted gently. My daughter died, monsieur. She died in childbirth, 19 years ago. I came to work here, and I have stayed ever since. And the baby? Your daughter's baby? But, monsieur, clearly you have not understood. I took the photograph album from him and shut it back in the bureau with my relics, my treasures. The things I have collected over the years, a first tooth, a child's shoe, a school certificate. My granddaughter is here. It's why I came here. Why I have worked here for all these years, in this building. I wanted to be close to her. I wanted to watch her grow up. A word from behind the penthouse door, and suddenly I am wrenched back into the present. I have just distinctly heard one of them say, "Concierge." I step backwards into the gloom, treading carefully to avoid the creaking floorboards. An instinct. I should not be here. I need to get back to my cabin. Now.
Mimi, fourth floor. I burst back into the apartment. I go straight to my room, straight to the window, stare out through the glass. It was hell sitting up there with all of them, talking, shouting at each other. I just wanted it to stop. I wanted so badly to be alone. Mimi. 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 It takes a moment for me to work out where the sound is coming from. I turn around and see Camille standing there in my doorway, hands on her hips. Mimi? She walks towards me, clicks her fingers in front of my face. Hello? What are you doing? Quoi? What? I stare at her. You were just staring out of the window like some sort of zombie. She does an impression, eyes wide, jaw hanging open. What were you looking at? I shrug. I hadn't even realized. But I must have been looking into his apartment. Old habits die hard. Putain, you're scaring me, Mimi. You've been acting so weird. She pauses, even weirder than normal. Then she frowns like she's working something out. Ever since the other night, when I came back late and you were still up. What is it?
Rien, I say. It's nothing. Why won't you just leave me alone?
I don't believe you, she says. What happened here before I got back that night? What's going on with you? I shut my eyes, clench my fists. I can't cope with all these questions, all this probing. I feel like I'm about to explode. With as much control as I can manage, I say, I need to be on my own right now, Camille. I need my own space. She doesn't take the hint. Hey, was it something to do with that guy you were being so mysterious about? Did it not work out? If you just tell me, maybe I could help. I can't take any more. The white noise is buzzing in my head. I stand up. I hate the way she's looking at me, the concern and worry in her expression. Why can't she just get it? I suddenly feel like I don't want to see her face anymore, like it would be better if she weren't here at all. Just shut up! Fuck off! Just leave me alone! She takes a step back. And I'm sick of you bugging me, I say. I'm sick of all your mess around the place, everywhere I look. I'm sick of you bringing your fuck buddies back here. I might be a widow, yes, I know all of your friends think that, but you're a disgusting little slut. I think I've done it now. Her eyes are wide as she steps further away from me. Then she disappears from the room. I don't feel good, but at least I can breathe again. I hear sounds coming from her bedroom next door, drawers being pulled open, cupboard door slamming. A few moments later, she appears with a couple of canvas bags over each arm, stuff spilling out of them. You know what? She says, I might be a disgusting little slut, but you are one crazy bitch. I can't be bothered with this anymore, Mimi. I don't need this. And Dominique's got her own place now. No more sneaking around. I'm out of here. There's only one person I know with that name. That doesn't make any sense. Dominique, yeah. Your brother's ex. And all that time he thought she was flirting with Ben. A little smile. That was a good decoy, right? Anyway, this is different. This is the real deal. I love her. It's one woman for me now. No more Camille, the... What was it you called me? Disgusting little slut. She hoists a bag higher on her shoulder. Buff. Whatever. I'll see you around, Mimi. Good luck with whatever the fuck is going on with you. A couple of minutes later, she's gone. I turn back to the window. I watch her striding across the courtyard, bags over her arm. For a moment, I actually feel better. Calmer. Freer. Like maybe I'll be able to think more clearly with her gone. But now it's too quiet. Because it's still here, the storm in my head, and I don't know whether I'm more frightened of it or of what it's drowning out. I lift my gaze from the courtyard. I look back into his apartment. A few days ago, I let myself in there with a key I stole from the concierge's cabin. I've been going into that cabin since I was a little girl, sneaking in, while I was sure the old woman was on one of the top floors cleaning. It used to fascinate me. It was like the cabin in the woods from a fairy tale. She has all these mysterious photographs on the walls, the proof she actually had another life before she came here, as hard as it is to believe. A beautiful young woman in so many of them, like a princess from the same fairy tale. Now I'm older, of course. I know that there's nothing magical about the cabin. It's just the tiny, lonely home of a poor old lady. It's depressing. But I still remembered exactly where she kept the master set of keys. Of course, she's not allowed to use them. They're in case of emergencies. If there was a flood in one of the apartments, say, while we were on holiday somewhere. And she doesn't have a set for my parents' apartment. That's off limits. It was early evening, dusk. I waited, watched him go out through the courtyard, like I watched Camille just now. He was only in a shirt and it was cold, so I didn't think he was going far. Perhaps just a few streets over to buy some cigarettes from the tabac, which still gave me enough time to do what I needed. I ran down the single flight of steps and let myself into the third floor apartment. Underneath my clothes, I was wearing the new lingerie I had bought with Camille. I could feel the secret, rustling slipperiness of it against my skin. I felt like someone braver, bolder. I was going to wait for him until he came back. I wanted to surprise him, and this way, I would be the one in control of the situation. I'd watched him so many times from my bedroom. But to stand in his apartment was different. I could feel his presence there, smell the scent of him beneath the strange, musty, old lady odor of the place. I wandered around for a while, just breathing him in. The whole time his cat stalked after me, watching me, like it knew I was up to no good. I opened his fridge and I rifled through his cupboards. I looked through his records, his collection of books. I went into his bedroom and lay down on his bed, which still had the imprint of his body in it, and I inhaled the scent of him on the pillows. I looked through the toiletries in his bathroom, opened the caps. I sprayed his lemon-scented cologne down the front of my shirt and in my hair. I opened his closet and buried my face in his shirts, but better were the shirts in his laundry basket, the ones he'd worn, the ones that smelt like his skin and sweat. Better even than that were the short hairs I found around the sink where he'd shaved and hadn't managed to wash them all away. I collected several on a finger. I swallowed them. If I'd watched myself, I might have said I looked like someone in the grip of an amour fou, an obsessive, mad love. But an amour fou is usually unrequited. And I knew that he felt the same way. That was the important thing. I just wanted to become a part of it, this world, his world. I'd had thousands of conversations with him in my head. I'd told him about my brothers, how horrible Antoine has always been to me, how Nick is really just a big loser who lives off Papa's money, and I honestly didn't get why Ben was friends with him. How the second I graduated, I'd be out of here, off to travel the world. We could go together. I found a glass in the kitchen and poured myself some of his wine, drank it down like it was a glass of grenadine. I needed to be drunk enough to do this. Then I took off my clothes. I lay down on his bed, waiting like a present left there on the pillow. But after a while I felt stupid. Maybe the wine was wearing off. I was a little too cold. This wasn't how I'd planned it in my head. I'd thought he'd have come back sooner. Half an hour ticked by. How long was he going to be? I wandered over to his desk. I wanted to read what he was writing so late into the night, scribbling notes, typing on his laptop. I found a notebook. A moleskin just like I use for my sketching. Another sign that we were meant to be. Twinned souls, soulmates. The music, the writing. We were so similar. That was what he was telling me that night when we sat in the darkened park together. And before that, when he gave me the record. Outsiders, but outsiders together. The book was full of notes for restaurant reviews, little doodles in between the writing, cards for restaurants tucked between the pages. It made me feel so close to him. His handwriting, beautiful, clever, a little spiky. Exactly as I would have imagined. Elegant like the fingers that had touched my arm that night in the park. I fell a little deeper in love seeing that writing. And then, on the last page, there was a note that had my name written there. A question mark after it, like this. Mimi? Oh my God. He'd been writing about me. I had to know more, had to find out what this meant. I opened his laptop. It asked me for the password. Merde. I hadn't a chance of getting in. It could be literally anything. I tried a couple of things. His surname, his favorite football team. I'd found a Manchester United shirt hanging in his closet. No luck. And then I had an idea. I thought of that necklace he always wore. The one he said came from his mum. I typed in, Saint Christopher. No, it bounced back at me. It was just a blind guess, so I wasn't surprised. But just because I could, I tried again, with numbers substituted for some of the letters, a tighter encryption. 5TCHR1ST0PH 3R. And this time, when I pressed enter, the password box closed and his desktop opened up. I stared at the screen. I couldn't believe I had guessed it. That had to mean something too, didn't it? It felt like a confirmation of how well I knew him. And I know writers are private about their work in the same way that I'm private about my art. But now it felt almost like he wanted whatever was on here to be found and read by me. I went to his documents to recent, and there it was at the top. All the others had the names of restaurants. They were obviously reviews. But this one was called Meunier Wines S-A-R-L. According to the little timestamp, this was what he had been working on an hour ago. I opened it. Merde! My heart was beating so fast. Excited, terrified, I began to read. But as soon as I did, I wanted to stop. I wished I had never seen any of it. I didn't know what I had expected, but this was not it. It felt like my whole world was caving in around me. I felt sick. But I couldn't stop.
Jess.